Indeed, with our very special guest tonight, Graham Hancock. You know, lots of strange things happening around this universe. We could call it supernatural things. In a moment, we're going to check in with Graham. His latest work is called Supernatural Meetings with the Ancient Teachers of Mankind. Graham Hancock has become recognized as an unconventional thinker who raises legitimate questions about humanity's history and prehistory and offers an increasingly popular challenge to the entrenched views of Orthodox scholars. He graduated from Durham University with first-class honors in sociology, then went on to pursue a career in quality journalism, writing for many of Britain's leading newspapers. He's our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Graham, welcome back. How are you?
Thank you. Nice to be back. How are you? I'm fine.
Doing great out here in the States. All is well, and you know, we just keep the program growing, and it seems to be working that way.
Quite a phenomenon.
Absolutely, Graham. Speaking of phenomena, this book, my gosh, Supernatural. How long have you been working on this one?
Well, it goes back many years, but in terms of a focused effort to actually write a book, about 3 years.
What's your take on, because so many people have their own definitions for the word, like supernatural. How about you?
Well, the supernatural, if we go strictly to the dictionary definition, we have science, we have observation of nature, and certain rules and forces have been established as the laws of nature. So supernatural technically is anything that cannot be explained within the existing laws and forces of nature. But probably a good idea to orient my own view on this from the outset, as it'll help to shed light as we go along. I think when we talk about supernatural beings, whether they be ghosts, whether they be demons, whether they be angels, whether they be fairies and elves, or even the latest manifestation of the supernatural, and I think that's largely what we're dealing with the so-called alien phenomenon. Mm-hmm. I believe that we are dealing with something real. I want to state this at the outset. It's something real. But it isn't something of our physical dimension. It exists in other dimensions and vibrates at a different frequency from the frequency that our senses are tuned to. And I think what is the common factor in all supernatural experiences is that the person or group of people who have those experiences are in what is called an altered state of consciousness. Now, altered states of consciousness can be brought about by a whole range of different techniques. Shamans in hunter-gatherer societies all around the world are the masters of this, and they have developed over tens of thousands of years a range of very specific techniques that are designed to put them into an altered state of consciousness so that they can effectively retune the receiver wavelength of their brain and tune in to these other dimensions and deal and negotiate directly with the supernatural beings who inhabit them. And amongst them, the most common shamanic technique is the cultivation of certain powerful plants, shamanic plants, which we in the West call hallucinogenic plants,
right,
which create visions or which make visions possible. But there are many other techniques, rhythmic dancing, certain kinds of music played repeatedly over long periods of time, austerities, starvation, even pain. Sometimes the atmosphere of particular places can have this effect. Electromagnetic fields can have this effect. This is why I think certain houses produce experiences of ghosts, because the house itself works on the consciousness of the individual. So there's a whole range of techniques and methods. Some people do this spontaneously. About 2% of every population have their brain chemistry at just the right setting to tune in to these other dimensions. But for those of us who are not in the 2%, we need a push. And either one of these shamanistic techniques, the use of plant hallucinogens, for example, or electromagnetic fields, intense electromagnetic fields, the environment of a particular place can push us temporarily into this altered state, and suddenly we start picking up the transmissions from the other side. It's like we open a secret doorway inside our brains and are able to project our consciousness through into other dimensions. And this, I think, is why the supernatural has proved so difficult to measure and investigate by the techniques of mainstream science, because mainstream science just can't go there. We have the instrument inside our heads. It's called our brains. And the essential factor is to retune its receiver wavelength. And the exciting thing from the study of shamanistic cultures that I've been involved in is that it offers us a reliable and systematic manner to investigate the supernatural realm. In other words, if we can learn from shamans, then it's possible for us to actually directly investigate this realm. And fortunately, some of our scientists, a very few, have begun to do this and have begun to do it in a scientific manner.
Are the shamans, Graham, approachable? I mean, will they talk to people who come up on them?
Absolutely. I've spent a great deal of time in the Amazon jungle working with shamans there, and I find them the most grounded, the most practical, the most reasonable people on Earth, extremely approachable. Many of these shamans, even in remote regions of the Amazon jungle, feel that they have a mission to the West. They feel that the West has become sick, and dangerous creature, and they see the evidence of this in the ongoing destruction of the rainforest all around them, and they feel that they understand the reason for this, that the West has lost contact with the spirit world. We no longer have a direct connection with the world of spirit. We've handed over our personal responsibilities in this area to a class of intermediaries, the priests, the mullahs, the rabbis, who themselves very rarely have any direct contact with supernatural realms, but simply repeat what they have been told by the previous generation. And in fact, many of the established religions are reluctant and unhappy at the idea that an individual might directly contact supernatural realms. But this, the shamans in the Amazon feel, is essential for the recovery of health by the West, that we reestablish our connection with the spirit. And as the shamans rightly say, the spirit, the supernatural world, is all around us all the time. It interpenetrates our lives in every way, whether we like it or not. And where they're different from us is that shamans have made a virtue of this. They've said, okay, the supernatural realm is there. It does affect everything we do. We must deal with it directly. We must investigate it. We must negotiate with it. This is what's so different about us in our society today, that we deny the existence of this realm. We want nothing to do with it. We diminish it. We deride it. We ignore it. We say, oh, we can't measure it. We can't weigh it. We can't count it. So therefore, it doesn't exist. The shamans of traditional societies have preserved and kept alive a tremendous mystery, and now is the time for us to learn to them. And yes, very approachable people.
Are these shamans, are they growing in stature, and I don't mean in height, but are we getting more and more of them, or are they dying off, Graham?
No, I would say in a curious kind of way, we're getting more and more of them, because I need to emphasize that what is the crucial characteristic of a shaman? The crucial characteristic of a shaman is that he or she is an individual who has mastered altered states of consciousness, who can put their consciousness into a different place and explore the realms that open up there. So the essence of shamanism is experience and practice. It isn't centuries of so-called knowledge or received wisdom handed down from generation to generation. It isn't a body of texts. It isn't a body of teachings. It's actual direct experience of the supernatural realm attained in deliberately induced altered states of consciousness. So the shaman is not a victim. The shaman is not like somebody possessed who is possessed by a spirit from the other world. On the contrary, the shaman is an active player entering the other realm and negotiating and dealing directly with the spirit beings there for the benefit of humanity. Now, in their own cultures, these men and women are primarily healers. That is their predominant role. A very few of them go bad, and they use the powers that they gain by entering the supernatural realm for evil purposes. And you can call those sorcerers, just as they were called in ancient times. But the vast majority, if we take the case of the Amazon, are curanderos, are healers. And they work their life is very dedicated to their community and to the healing and to the good health of their community. And they just recognize and absolutely understand that we cannot deal with any single health problem or any single problem of the world today if we do not deal with the realm of the spirit, if we do not take that into account. And every sickness that we see in the world today, including the disastrous state of international relations, if we go down right to the bottom of it, we'll find that there is a spiritual cause. And if we fail to address that spiritual cause, we will never, never, never solve the problem. So in answer to your question, are shamans becoming more common or less common? I would say more and more shamans exist, and many in the West can rightly be regarded as shamans now, who have pursued this experience of altered states of consciousness and of using altered states in a systematic manner to directly project our consciousness into other realms and other dimensions. The number of those individuals is increasing, and increasingly Western shamans are offering ceremony, because the ceremonial context in which the altered state of consciousness takes place is absolutely vital. It's part of the retuning of the brain. And gradually this idea is emerging from the depths of the rainforests and taking its place in the modern world in which we live. And I believe it's just in time for us. It's what we need most of all today.
You know, Graham, you had just mentioned spirits, fairies, aliens, that they may all indeed be the same thing.
Yeah.
How about your evidence on something like that?
Well, I think that first it came to me gradually, and I should preface this remark by speaking of the extraordinary work that was done in 1969 by Jacques Vallée, whose book Passport to Magonia is an absolute classic and a wonderful work of scholarship, and was the very first investigation to seriously compare the so-called alien abduction experience and encounters with aliens with the phenomenon that was called fairies and elves in the Middle Ages. And what I've done is, in Supernatural, in a section of Supernatural, is I've taken that inquiry on with all the new evidence that has become available since 1969, and I've added to it a very specific investigation into the beings that shamans all over the world call spirits. And at one level, it's really extremely simple. If you just listen to what people say and look at what the spirits that shamans deal with do, at what fairies and elves were reported to do to our ancestors in the Middle Ages, and what aliens, so-called aliens, do today, you'll find that they are all doing absolutely the same thing. Very intriguing similarity. Perhaps people who've only superficially studied the alien abduction phenomenon may not be aware of this, but a great deal of very serious scientific work was done on the alien abduction phenomenon, for example, by Professor John Mack of Harvard University.
God rest his soul.
A wonderful man and a friend of mine, and what a tragedy that we lost him in such an unnecessary traffic accident, which actually happened in London. And then David Jacobs at Temple University, Bud Hopkins and others have done very serious work over the years drawing out the reports of UFO abductees, of people who believe they've been abducted by aliens. And it's very intriguing that in a large number of cases, in fact, the majority of cases, the being that later transforms into a typical gray first appears in the form of an animal, or in a part animal, part human form. Now, there's a technical term for part animal, part human creatures, and that is therianthropes, and that comes from the Greek therion, which means wild beast, and anthropos, which means man. And it's astonishing how commonly UFO abductees first meet their aliens in this therianthropic form, as part animal, part human. They're shapeshifters, they're transformers. Now, amazingly, if you go back into the medieval records, you find that exactly the same is true of fairies and elves. I have a 14th century woodcut from Holland sitting on my desk, which shows a group of fairies, and they are dancing in a ring, and these beings are part human and part animal. They have horns and hooves, and at the same time, a human appearance. And that is how fairies were seen at that time. Another was the fearsome medieval fairy, whose name was Melusine, and she was part serpent and part human.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Graham.
Well, she was feared because she used to abduct human babies. And there were repeated cases of fairies and humans being involved in mating, in breeding, exactly as we have in the reports of alien abductions, that there's this appears from the other world to be this sexual interest in the human race. The same is true of the spirits that shamans deal with. Many shamans experience themselves to be abducted by the spirits. They're taken up into the sky. They're forced to have sex with them. Many shamans believe that they have a spirit wife and children in the other world. So strongly do they believe this that it actually causes damage to their relationships in this world. And again, this is very common with alien abductees, and was common with people abducted by fairies in the Middle Ages. So there's just an astonishing range of similarities and connections uniting these three phenomena. And my sense is that we are dealing with the same being. And I can actually trace the first documents referring to these beings, the painted caves of Upper Paleolithic Europe, back 35,000 years. This has been a continuous experience in human culture, but I honestly don't think it is physical nuts and bolts aliens from other planets in this physical universe. I think the problem is much more mysterious and much more interesting than that. I think the evidence suggests we're dealing with transdimensional beings that have an interest in us, and that evolution has equipped us with a means to contact.
What brought you to this point, to this theory?
Well, I really started out having worked for many, many years on the subject of the lost civilization. I suppose my best-known book is Fingerprints of the Gods. And Fingerprints of the Gods gathered
a classic,
together.
By the way, Graham, an absolute classic.
Thank you. The book is very dear to my heart. And it was published in 1995. And I spent many years working around that specific subject, trying to shed light on the possibility that there may have been a huge forgotten episode in human civilization, a lost civilization, in fact. And I worked in depth on this subject through a series of books, of which the last was Underworld, which was published in 2002. And for Underworld, I took this investigation as far as I could possibly take it. I learned to become a scuba diver. And I did deep and dangerous dives more than 2,000 dives, in fact, in locations all around the world, looking for the submerged traces of a lost civilization. And indeed, I found a great deal. But when I had published that book, I felt, actually, I have taken this investigation as far as I personally can take it. There's a danger, if I continue down this track, that I'm just going to end up repeating myself and not saying anything new. And it's time for other people to step into this area of inquiry, and time for me to move on. And I had always had, I'd always had a great interest in the mystery of human origins. Who are we? Where do we come from? Why are we here? And I decided that I would investigate that mystery, that this would be my next project. I'd already been accumulating information on it for years and years and years. But as I really got into the subject, I found, unexpectedly found, that I had to deal with the supernatural that our ancestors were dealing with the supernatural, that the supernatural may have been the key that made them human in the first place. This was the mystery that I found myself up against, and I realized that my inquiry was ultimately going to concern much more the nature of reality than just the issue of human origins.
Stay with us. Graham Hancock, our special guest with his book, Supernatural: Meetings with the Ancient Teachers of Mankind. I'm George Norrie. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, if you've been thinking about becoming a Streamlink member, just don't know what to do, just go to the coasttocoastam.com website, take a look at the Streamlink section there, and then you can figure out what might be the best tool for you. Streamlink from Coast to Coast AM. You talk about, Graham, in your book, and I find this to be a very, very exciting segment, that a light being switched on the human brain all around the world, more or less at the same time. Explain that, because I don't quite figure it out.
Well, it's not so much a question of a light being. It's more a metaphor that I'm using. I'm saying that there's a certain moment in human prehistory when it seems as though a light has been literally switched on, like somebody flipped a switch, switched on in the human brain all over the world. And this was the one of the mysteries that that drew me into this inquiry. Because if you look at what anthropologists call the human career, the whole story of the human race, you have a story that's a roughly 6 million years long, back to the last common ancestor with the chimpanzee, when our line diverged from our very close relatives, the chimpanzee. And really, and unfortunately, this is a story of 6 million years of boredom. Our ancestors do absolutely nothing. As time gradually passes, we find from the few remains in the fossil record that they're beginning to look more and more like us. They start off about 3 feet tall as adults, with tiny, tiny brains, even smaller than the brains of a chimpanzee. And gradually, over the millions and millions of years, they get taller, they get more upright, they perfect walking on two legs, their brow ridges begin to recede, the brain size gets bigger and bigger. By 500,000 years ago, our ancestors have brains exactly the same size as ours, and by 200,000 years ago, they are fully anatomically modern in every sense. There's a skeleton from Ethiopia dating to 196,000 years ago, which is in every sense identical to a modern human being. You wouldn't blink if you passed this individual in the street. He looks exactly like you or I. And brain casts tell us that their brain size was identical to ours. The brain was organized in the same way as ours. We're dealing with us. Genetically, they're identical to us. And yet, despite looking like us and being genetically identical to us, these beings of 200,000 years ago don't behave like human beings at all. They behave like shuffling, tool-using apes. They have no religion, no culture, no art, no lateral thinking. They're really bad hunters. It's amazing that they managed to survive for millions of years.
As long as they did, yeah.
Yeah, they have no broader wisdom whatsoever. They just seem to live for the moment and incredibly dull. So although we might not bat an eyelid if we passed them in the street, they would certainly send us to sleep if we listened to them at a dinner conversation. And this goes on for more than another 100,000 years, and it's really, you have to really come down until just 40,000 years ago, or even less, 35,000 years ago, when suddenly, all over the world, you get evidence that a tremendous change has taken place in this being. It's as though something has been done to our ancestors. And suddenly, almost out of the blue, we are creating the most extraordinary transcendent art that the world has ever seen. And this is the art of the painted caves of southern Europe and of the rock shelters of places like South Africa and Australia. You find the art in North America and in South America, painted, always painted on rocks or in caves. And you know, the famous cave of Lascaux in France, which dates back about 20,000 years. When Pablo Picasso, the great artist, entered that cave in the 1930s, when he came out, he was interviewed by reporters, and he just stood there amazed. And he said, you know, we have invented nothing. That these people of so long ago were creating this just amazing world-class art. And the mystery is that they do it absolutely out of nowhere. One minute they are these shuffling ape men. They look like us, but their behavior is that of ape men. The next minute they are producing works of art that stunned Pablo Picasso. And this is the mystery as to why did this light switch on in our brains. And I think the clue to that mystery, the answer to that mystery, is found in the art itself, because an absolutely universal characteristic of this mysterious rock and cave art all around the world is that it features those beings that I mentioned in the last segment that are technically referred to as therianthropes, part animal, part human beings. They're in a state of transformation between human and animal. So you see a man with the head of a bison and the hooves of a bison. You see the figure of a woman who, the woman is actually depicted headless, but the head of a lion is emerging from her arm. So this is not a question of people being dressed up in skins. This is a question of actual transformation, a shape-shifting, transforming being. And these are the very earliest paintings that we have from anywhere in the world, are these paintings of beings that can only be described as supernatural beings, because we do not encounter beings like that in everyday life. These were not paintings from nature. These artists were depicting something that they had seen and that had a very powerful impact on them. And I believe that's exactly what happened, that they cultivated altered states of consciousness, perhaps the first by accident.
How do we know they weren't just hallucinating, Greg?
Well, you see, this is the crucial question, because we have to try to understand what hallucinations are. The phenomenon called hallucinations, or visions, if you like, is very poorly studied. There was work that was done on this during the 50s and 60s, and then with the tremendous hysteria that accompanied the war on drugs, when just all drugs were lumped together in one category and called bad, the work that psychiatrists had been doing with hallucinogens and human volunteers, which allow us to directly study this this mystery, was stopped. And in fact, that work wasn't started again until the 1990s. And perhaps we'll come on later to a discussion of Rick Strassman's incredible work with dimethyltryptamine and DMT. But the point is this: we actually don't know what hallucinations are. Many scientists just dismiss them as wanderings of the mind and say they're absolutely meaningless, that in an altered state of consciousness, the individual is bizarrely stitching together elements from his or her personal memory and imagination, and these are what hallucinations are. Absolutely no evidence for that theory whatsoever, and a great deal that contradicts it, most notably that in these altered states of consciousness, particularly those that are induced by shamanic plants and other shamanic techniques, people from all different cultures and all different parts of the world and all different periods of time all seem to encounter the same other world, inhabited by the same incredible supernatural beings who have teachings to give us. They may do strange and terrifying things to us, but they always also teach us. And that is true in the latest incarnation of this phenomenon, which is the alien abduction phenomenon. Hallucinations are a kind of perception. We don't even understand everyday perception. We don't understand how we do, of course, understand the lenses of the eye, but we do not understand how this 3 or 4 pounds of jelly inside our skulls that we call our brains transforms light rays into consciousness, into experiences, into emotions. We don't understand how that happens at all. And it's well understood that every perception is affected by the culture and the background of the individual who has those perceptions. I believe the same is true for hallucinations. They are another form of perception. particularly as cultivated by shamans. They are another form of perception, and they also are affected by our cultural background. So what happens is that as these experiences are undergone in different cultures, the culture imposes itself on those experiences. You get slight regional variations as a result of different cultures, but the astonishing thing is that at root, everybody is seeing the same thing. And this is incredibly hard to explain. If the idea is that this imagery is hardwired into our brains in some way by genetics, by evolution, then we have almost a bigger mystery as to how it got there. But for me, the most elegant and the most satisfactory explanation, and one that increasing numbers of scientists who work with altered states of consciousness are coming to consider, is that what happens to us in an altered state is that the receiver wavelength of our brains is retuned, allowing us to gain access to other dimensions, perhaps the very dimensions that quantum physicists speak so much about these days, allow us to get into those dimensions, to contact and to deal with their inhabitants. And this is what shamans do every day of the week.
Now, the mere fact that this seems to be growing, at least that's my perception, the growing in the faith, the growing in the ability, in the need to do some things that are outside of the box. Do you see that yourself, Graham?
There's a desperate need. People all over the world, individuals, good people, are deeply concerned and troubled by what is happening in the world. It seems that our governments are out of control, that the juggernaut of industry and technology is out of control, that we are being marched blindfold towards the abyss of catastrophe by governments and industry that have utterly lost contact with the reason we are here on this planet in the first place, that have utterly lost contact with the mystery of the spirit. And I think people everywhere are reaching to find an answer to this. And unfortunately, the mainstream, the orthodox religions, all too often become part of the problem rather than a solution to the problem. We have to put our hands on our hearts and honestly admit that a huge amount of the dreadful, vicious, and evil conflict that is taking place in the world today has to do with people's religious sentiments and ideas.
Yes, so
true. And these are religions that they have simply received from their parents at childhood and accepted as true. They've never used their consciousness to investigate the propositions of the religion. They are simply told it's true by the previous generation, and they tell the next generation that it's true. And you can trace this back down the generations, one generation telling the next, this is true. And on the basis of that alone, the word of the previous generation, no other facts, no other information, no direct personal experience, people come to deeply prejudiced conclusions about the nature of the world we live in and about others. And this leads to horrific conflicts where people believe that their way is right and no other way can possibly be right. Whereas, aren't we all, in our depths, reaching for the mystery and meaning of life and reaching to recontact the spirit? And it may be that this very old form of religion, the form of religion that actually made us human in the first place, shamanism, direct contact with the spirit realm, that this may be where the saving of the human race lies, if only we can recognize it. And I think that sense, that consciousness, it's the hope for the future, is spreading around the world now, slowly at first, but gathering pace and coming to a point where the vested interests, the powers that be, big government with its gray bureaucracies that seeks to control every aspect of our lives, that seeks even to reach inside our brains and control what we may and may not experience, that this destructive and deadly system is on its last legs, and that the future lies in the hands of individuals who are prepared to go forward bravely and experience their lives for themselves.
Do you think government will try to capture these people eventually once they become known for their own experiments?
Well, I think that we already have a situation in which, puzzlingly and perplexingly, although we believe we live in democracies and free societies, there are powerful, rigid rules in place which prevent us from experimenting with our own consciousness. You know, my consciousness is what makes me human. It's the most precious aspect of humanity. And I find it extraordinary that in the privacy of my own home, doing no harm to others, I am forbidden by law and may be sent to prison for many years for making use of certain natural plants which shamans, for example, in the Amazon have used for tens of thousands of years to contact the spirit world. It seems to me extraordinary that governments seek to control the experiences we have inside our heads, not what we do, but simply the experiences we have. This is a very sinister development. It's a huge intrusion on the liberty of a responsible adult in an advanced society, and yet we're being persuaded to accept this as the normal run of things. And I do find it very, very disturbing. It smacks of George Orwell's 1984. It smacks of the thought police. That certain thoughts are not allowed to be had, that one may not consider certain things. And our society wants to turn us all into robots who are absolutely dedicated and committed to the alert, competitive, problem-solving mentality that is the basis of modern life. And our society seeks to deny all other forms of consciousness, except perhaps stupefied drunkenness, which is authorized by our societies since it poses no threat whatsoever to the status quo.
You know, Graham, I'm with you on this, and it's fascinating to discuss just the possibilities. Are you at a point now, though, where you too believe that whatever's going on is probably multidimensional as opposed to truly physical, the physical that we understand?
Yes, I do believe that what's going on is multidimensional. It may be possible that, and there is some evidence for this, that in the interactions between dimensions, it may be that beings from other dimensions can even break through physically into this dimension. I don't rule that out, and there are elements of this, intriguing elements of this in some alien abduction reports. But I do think, in essence, that we are not dealing with beings who we could eventually find if we had a sophisticated enough spaceship that we could send out at the speed of light into the universe to explore other planets. There may well be beings on other planets. I'm full the universe sure that the universe is full of life, and that's what the universe is for. But this experience, this contact that is taking place, is taking place at an interdimensional level, and that is why it is so difficult to measure using the empirical weigh them, measure them, and count them techniques of Western science. We need a different technique to investigate this kind of reality, and that's where, with humility, we need to turn to the knowledge and the experience and the wisdom of the shamans of tribal and hunter-gatherer cultures who have kept the light of this mystery alive for tens of thousands of years.
Prior to the book Supernatural, have you changed your views at all, Graham, or did you always think this way?
Well, I say that my views have been in constant evolution. I have had experiences while researching Supernatural because naturally I have experimented with these shamanic plants myself. I couldn't write about altered states of consciousness without experiencing where these plants take us to, particularly ayahuasca in the Amazon, but other shamanic plants as well. And these experiences have, I have to say, have completely changed my view of reality. I do not think any longer that we are dealing with a simple, measurable, and tangible reality. Reality is incredibly complex. It's multi-layered. It's multi-dimensional. We are plugged into a certain part of it. Our society forces us to shift our attention from other dimensions and focus exclusively on this dimension, to tune into the transmissions of channel normal, if you like. But there are other transmissions, other realities all around us, and it is part of our birthright to be able to contact those realities, and shamans have shown us the way. And after one has contacted those other realities, and ayahuasca is an extraordinary way to do that, one never feels the same again.
All right, stay with us. We're going to talk more about some supernatural happenings when we come back. Graham's website's linked up at coasttocoastam.com, but it's grahamhancock.com. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And our special guest tonight, Graham Hancock, next hour, we'll open up the phone lines. We'll give you an opportunity to talk with Graham. We'll be back with more questions in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Graham, so you are a believer in the supernatural. You are a believer in ghosts, per se, right?
Yeah, I kind of don't want to use the word believer because it implies such credulity. I want to say that I've been working seriously on this problem for a number of years from a completely different angle to the angle that most people come at the supernatural from. I've been looking at it from the perspective of human consciousness, and what I think I've established is that an altered state of consciousness is and must be involved in all supernatural experiences. And these altered states of consciousness may come about by a variety of means. Surveys indicate that around 2% of every human population, 2% of the American population, 2% of the British population, for that matter, have a brain chemistry in such a state of flux that they are able to slip spontaneously into deep trance states, altered states of consciousness. And I think that the majority of people who have the UFO abduction experience are amongst that 2%.
Do you believe, though, that visitations, some of them could be physical, or do you think it's just
I think they increasingly have a physical element. I believe absolutely, and I set this the evidence for this out at length in my book Supernatural, that we are dealing with interdimensional contact here, that this is the best possible explanation for it. But there has been evidence going back through human history that it may not simply be a matter of us being able to project our consciousness through into other realms and relate to the beings there, as shamans indeed still do to this day. There may also be breakthroughs from those other realms into this realm. There may even be technologies in those other realms. When I look at accounts of the fairy dance, as it used to be called in medieval Europe, where these groups of beings would whirl incredibly rapidly in a ring, and any human who came close to this dance circle would be drawn into it and propelled through into another world. And they might experience themselves as having been there just for a few hours, but when they come back, they find that days or even weeks or months or years have passed on Earth. I think that the latest version of that technology is the thing that we call the UFO, that it right. is also a vehicle for movement between dimensions. Now, we humans have not yet got to the stage where we have developed vehicles that can cross between the dimensions, but we have this amazing instrument inside our skulls called our brains. Which have been designed by millions of years of evolution to allow us contact to these other realms, because contact with those other realms is vital for our survival, vital for our understanding of ourselves, vital for our health. We have the ability to contact it. It's just in modern society we've shut that ability down, and we fear it, and we despise it, and we even demonize and criminalize it. Whereas in tribal and hunter-gatherer societies, that ability to shift one's consciousness into contact with other dimensions is highly prized, and is the ability of shamans throughout the world. So I think we're dealing with an incredibly complicated problem here. It's no wonder that science has found it hard to come to grip with the supernatural and with the UFO phenomenon, because there is so little that is measurable and observable in the direct materialist terms that mainstream science is used to. But when we come down to the level of consciousness and realize that, that the brain, the traditional model is that these things called visions or hallucinations are actually made up in the brain. They're just sort of cooked up in the brain. They're generated by the brain. But we don't think that, for example, when we stand and look at a beautiful sunset or meet a fellow human being who is very striking to us in one way or another. We don't think that experience is being generated by our brains. We naturally think that there is an outside reference point, whether it's the sunset or the beautiful person, which is giving us that experience. And the evidence I present is that the same is absolutely true of those experiences that we call visions and hallucinations, that there is indeed an outside reference point, but it is not of this world and thus cannot be measured with this world technology. We need to use the technology of consciousness that shamans have mastered in order to negotiate and deal with these other realms. In other words, we need to change our state of consciousness. We need to retune the receiver wavelength of the brain.
Why does DNA figure so prominently in your book, Supernatural?
Well, this is this again is an area of inquiry that I did not expect that I was going to get into when I began research on this subject. But I was presented with a mystery, which is all around the world. Going back, the earliest surviving evidence we have for this dates back 35,000 years to a little cave called Fumane Cave in Italy, in northern Italy near Verona. And in that cave is encountered the first ever cave painting to have survived, the oldest cave painting that we so far know about. And what it shows is a supernatural being. It shows a creature that does not exist in this daily life. It shows a creature with horns and hooves, a part animal, part human combination. And that combination is exactly how many modern UFO abductees report that so-called aliens first appear to them. So we are dealing with a phenomenon that has been with us for tens of thousands of years. And exactly at the moment that our ancestors started painting these images of recognizable supernatural beings, that's exactly the moment that the whole suite of modern human behavior was switched on at once. Suddenly, overnight, we became very cunning hunters. We started to anticipate where the great herds of game would be. We started to track and plan their movements in ways that we'd never done before. We invented increasingly cunning and complicated tools. Our social organization stepped up. We began to weave textiles and fabrics. It literally was, as I said earlier, as though a light was switched on in the human brain all over the world. And exactly the moment it happens, we find the first ever recorded, documented evidence of our contact with supernatural beings. And I believe that the key, and there's a huge amount of academic evidence for this, which I report in Supernatural. This is the first time in my career as a researcher that I actually find myself agreeing with the mainstream academics, because the prevailing theory in anthropology now of the study of cave and rock art around the world is that indeed it was done by artists who had experienced altered states of consciousness, by shamans who perhaps had stumbled across plants which they initially thought were food items, perhaps psilocybin mushrooms, and they consumed them as food items. And then they found that that this opened a door in their consciousness, and they found themselves in contact with other beings and other worlds, and they documented those contacts on the cave walls. And exactly at the moment they did it, that's the moment that we became fully human. So this is a crucial moment in human history, and it wasn't just a moment. It has continued without cease down the ages, this transit to and fro with other dimensions, this transdimensional contact with beings who sometimes hurt us, but very often in a strange way seem to love us and to care about us and to want to bring out the best in us. And never before has such contact been so badly needed as it is today.
Has this been an evolution for you, Graham? Because I don't think you've always felt these views.
No, it has. It has been an evolution, and a crucial part of the evolution, first of all, has been a dispassionate study of the evidence, the evidence for what is involved with the supernatural, and secondly, the personal experiences that I have had. I traveled to the Amazon to work with traditional shamans there, drinking the powerful plant brew that they use in order to reach the other world. And that brew is called ayahuasca. It means the vine of souls. And in fact, it's made up of two different plants. One of them is a vine, one of these creepers that hangs down from the tall trees in the Amazon. And the other are the leaves of a bush. And the bush is known as chacruna in the Amazon. Its scientific name is Cicotria viridis. And this bush, its leaves contain an extremely powerful hallucinogen, which is illegal in the West. although it is in fact produced naturally in minute quantities in our own brains, in the pineal glands of our own brains. And this substance is called DMT, dimethyltryptamine. Now, the interesting thing is that DMT cannot be absorbed orally, and yet in the Amazon, they drink it in a tea, and it has these extraordinary effects. And the reason is because the other ingredient of the brew, the ayahuasca vine, contains a chemical that turns off the enzyme in our stomachs that normally destroys DMT on contact. It's an extraordinary achievement of science in the Amazon, if you like, that they discovered that these two plants had these properties only when mixed together. It can't simply be a matter of trial and error. And when you ask the shamans about it, they say the spirits of the plants told us what to do. They always tell us what to do. And the spirit of ayahuasca is frequently seen. I myself have seen her in this form, and so have many other sane and rational, grounded people from all around the world who have drunk ayahuasca. The spirit of ayahuasca very often appears in the form of an enormous serpent, or sometimes a seething mass of serpents. And she has lessons for us. Drinking ayahuasca has been described as joining a school. Professor Benny Shannon of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, who is the leading academic expert on ayahuasca, describes it on that way, that it was like entering a school that had a program of teaching for him. And that's exactly the way the shamans in the Amazon describe it, and that's exactly the way that experienced it too, that there's some kind of teaching program going on here, and that it is external to us in some way. And this is, you asked earlier about DNA. Why does DNA figure so much in my work? I was looking for a solution to this mystery. Why do people from all over the world experience the same things in altered states of consciousness? The best explanation, I believe, is that we are dealing with freestanding parallel dimensions, which our consciousness is able to enter in these states. But another possibility that has to be looked at is that this information, this teaching program that is unleashed by these plants, may in some way be imprinted on our DNA, something that all human beings have in common. And if it were imprinted on our DNA, then that would explain why the same teachings are given to everybody. It doesn't matter if it's 35,000 years ago or today, a kind of interactive teaching program. And so I investigated that possibility as well. You know, we can understand why useful everyday abilities might be hardwired into our DNA. For example, so-called intuitive physics. If you were to throw a, if we were in the same room and you were to throw a rock at me, I could step out of the way, hopefully, and avoid that rock. Right. And in so doing, I would actually be bringing into bear hardwired knowledge. My brain would be doing tremendous mathematical calculations, trajectory, mass, speed, all kinds of trigonometry. I wouldn't even know it. I would just step out of the way. And we can understand why. Yeah, one can understand why evolution has given us this intuitive physics, as it's called. But why should evolution give every human being on the planet, once they enter an altered state of consciousness, a brain module for beings that appear to be half animal and half human, that teach very specific information to us? Information, by the way, that's been taught to scientists. Francis Crick, the Nobel Prize winner, who won the Nobel Prize for discovering the structure of DNA itself, admitted shortly before his death in 2004 that he had been under the influence of LSD when he first saw the double helix pattern. It was a teaching given to him in a vision. So the other possibility that we have to consider is that some intelligence may have written this information onto our DNA, perhaps written it on the first DNA that ever appeared on this planet, and it has been conserved and passed down ever since across billions of years of evolution until finally a creature evolved that was able to read that information, and that creature is us. And in order to read it, we need to be in altered states of consciousness. But to explain that parallel inquiry that I undertake in Supernatural, I need to tell you a little bit more about the amazing Nobel Prize winner Francis Crick and the extraordinary ideas he had about how and why life first started on this planet.
Well, he was a genius, obviously deserved his Nobel Prize, and did a lot of hard work. David Icke, by the way, you know David, wanted to entice me by going on a field trip with them, and he said, I'll get you some Hiawatha. And I just said, you know, David, I'm not going to take this trip this time. Didn't want to do it.
Well, it's not so difficult. There are some. It's an extraordinary experience, and perhaps we should talk about it some more in the next sector. One thing I do want to make clear, and I think it's very important for everybody to understand, is that ayahuasca and these other shamanic plant hallucinogens are not addictive drugs. In fact, there is no addictive hallucinogen. On the contrary, ayahuasca and the Central African shamanic hallucinogen called ibogaine have both been used with astonishing success to get drug addicts off their addiction to hard drugs, cocaine and heroin addictions. Up to 50% of cocaine and heroin addicts who undergo a course of treatment with ayahuasca, which I think is properly thought of as a medicine rather than a drug, up to 50% abandon their addiction without withdrawal symptoms and never return to it. And healers are quietly working with these substances all over the Western world today, but our governments will not accept them because they consider them to be quote-unquote drugs like any other drugs. But their fantastic healing effect is very, very clear. Harvard Medical School has conducted a 15-year study with regular ayahuasca users in Brazil, where ayahuasca is legal and protected by laws of religious freedom. And there they have found only positive effects. They have not found any negative effects. People who were alcoholics before are no longer alcoholics as a result of drinking ayahuasca. People who used to beat their wives now have happy and calm family lives. They've become positive, contributing citizens, and across the board there's been a 6-point increase in IQ. So
that's
We have to think again about this substance. It's very hard work to drink it, and I'll tell you about this in the next segment. It makes you very ill, you vomit, you have diarrhea, but you have these extraordinary, life-changing and healing encounters. I do know of examples, personally, of examples of people who've even been cured of cancers following the drinking of ayahuasca. So a whole new field of information has to come out about this substance.
Everybody gets sick, though, when they try it?
Almost everybody does suffer from vomiting and diarrhea. One of the names that it's known by in the Amazon is the purge. And this is very difficult for us in Western society to deal with, especially in a public setting. But I think it teaches us a very important lesson, which is to let go of our bodies and concentrate on this majestic thing that we have, which is called our minds, our consciousness.
At this point, it's illegal here in the United States, right?
Well, in Brazil, there are many groups in the cities who've developed what you would call syncretistic churches, which mix Christianity with the traditional consumption of ayahuasca or certain kinds of philosophical ideas. And one of these, the União de Vegetal, the UDV, has recently won a vitally important test case in New Mexico, which is federally relevant and which was settled in the Supreme Court. And they have established that their members are allowed to drink ayahuasca legally in the United States because it is a religious sacrament. It is part of a religion. In that sense, it's rather similar to the Native American church and the use of peyote. So the first steps have been taken to remove the sanction of legal repression and of social stigma, and to bring this amazing healing plant from the Amazon into the mainstream.
I'll tell you what I'm going to do. This is a fascinating subject with our guest, Graham Hancock. We'll open up the Fast Blasts. We'll take some Fast Blast questions, and we'll also open up the phone lines right here on Coast to Coast AM. And our special guest tonight, Graham Hancock, we're going to open up the phone lines a little earlier just to take advantage of Graham being here and your ability to get to us, and then we'll take Fast Blast questions, too, on Coast to Coast AM. So, Graham, as you write about 50,000 years ago, humankind couldn't do much, and then all of a sudden there was this dramatic evolution, this incredible brain power that we possess today. What do you think happened?
Well, to cut a long story short and recap a little of what we've been over in the previous segments, I think our ancestors discovered altered states of consciousness. And I think they initially discovered these altered states through their encounters with certain plants that they perhaps sampled as food items, such as psilocybin mushrooms, which then completely changed their state of consciousness and put them into direct contact with what they experienced as supernatural beings, with teachings for them from another realm. And I think it was those teachings, and that's why my book, the main title is Supernatural, but the subtitle is Meetings with the Ancient Teachers of Mankind. I believe that these encounters with these very probably transdimensional beings, or alternatively with a mysterious teaching program recorded on our DNA, were what actually made us human. And the trick is, we have to be in altered states of consciousness to access these teachings. We cannot access them in the normal, alert, competitive, problem-solving state of mind that is so encouraged and praised in modern society today. That state of mind is very important, and it's part of our duty as human beings to be connected, really connected, to the material world. But we shouldn't lose sight of the spiritual part of ourselves, which may be the greater and the bigger part of ourselves, and which the historical record shows was fundamental in making us human. We shouldn't lose sight of that, and of the fact that our evolution has equipped us with a means to make contact with those realms in altered states of consciousness outside of the everyday life.
David writes us from Ontario, Canada, Thunder Bay, Ontario, in Canada. He said, do the shamans repeat any warnings for end times?
And yes.
Yeah, tell me about that.
Absolutely. I have spoken to so many shamans who feel that we are at a crossroads, that some great change, some tremendous change is coming, is looming up on our horizon. And let's not forget that the ancient Maya of Central America were fundamentally a shamanistic culture. They too made paintings of spirit beings inside caves. They too cultivated altered states of consciousness. In fact, the use of hallucinogenic plants was astonishingly widespread across Central America, and particularly cultivated by the Maya. And it's the Maya, in their amazing calendar, who come up with this specific warning of an end of the world, effectively. And when we translate their calendar into our calendar, as I think every listener to this show knows, we come up with the date of the 21st or the 23rd of December, 2012. Now, what is going on here is very complicated and very difficult. If you look back deep into human history and look at the ancient cultures, you find that they tell us that there have been cataclysms in the past, that great human civilizations have been washed away and destroyed, almost entirely forgotten from human memory, and that every time this has happened, human behavior has been implicated in the disaster, that the things we do, we human beings do, bring down this disaster on ourselves. And that's what the shamans were telling me in the Amazon. Look at the dreadful things that are happening in the Amazon. The Amazon is the lungs of the world. If we allow the Amazon to be destroyed, then we are going to face a cataclysm. And the Amazon,
and it's happening, Graham.
And
they
it's
are.
Happening. It's yeah. happening in front of our eyes for incredibly short-sighted and stupid reasons. There is terrible poverty in Peru and Brazil. That poverty leads people to settle new lands, to slash down the forest, to create farms. Migrant laborers are being employed by huge international enterprises on soybean farms. Can you imagine they're cutting down the old growth forest of the Amazon and replacing it with soybean farms, the soybeans to feed cattle to give us hamburgers? And after 10 years, those farms are useless because the soil only supports rainforest. It was never intended to grow soybeans. What an incredible mistake we are making. If the root cause of this problem is poverty, then let us solve that problem. The entire problem of the Amazon could be solved with just 6 months spending in Iraq. We could have the Amazon secure forever with just 6 months spending in Iraq. All that's really needed is to pay the people of the Amazon to look after it, to protect this precious treasure for the world. But instead, because of short-sighted, ignorant, greedy thinking, we are allowing this incredible resource to be destroyed. We are literally burning the lifeboat in which we all live. It's madness, absolute madness.
Kaylin from Garden Grove, California writes, have you, Mr. Graham, encountered any reports of ET telepathic contact during any kind of events?
Not only have I encountered such reports, but I've had such experiences directly myself under the influence of ayahuasca. It is very commonly reported by shamans that they meet beings in their altered states of consciousness who are in flying saucers and who look very much like the Western conception of an ET. And it was very mysterious for me on one of my ayahuasca sessions in Peru, one in particular, although it happened to me on several occasions, that I found myself in this deeply altered state of consciousness confronting a being. That seemed exactly like the conventional idea of an ET. And, you know, one could argue that I had just picked that idea up from the culture, that somehow it had infiltrated my mind and that's why I saw it. But the evidence is quite the contrary because, as I mentioned earlier, the active ingredient of ayahuasca is DMT, dimethyltryptamine. And experiments were conducted in the early 1950s before any UFO or alien abduction had been reported. People were given a DMT and asked to comment on their experiences. And a great many of them reported being taken up into the sky, into metal objects by small beings who did painful experiments on them. Exactly the same experience that would later be reported as the UFO abduction experience. Now, I resist the idea that these are straightforward extraterrestrials. In other words, that they can simply be explained as physical beings like us, but from other planets revolving around other stars elsewhere in the universe. I don't think that that's the explanation for what's going on. I think it's much more mysterious than that, and I think it has to do with transdimensional contact and the interpenetration of dimensions and the impact that intelligent beings in different dimensions can have upon us. And I do feel, and I present evidence for this, that there has been 35,000 years of contact with these other dimensions and that it has played a fundamental part in making human beings what we are today. And that if we want to get to grips with this mystery and really want to get to grips with the ET mystery, as it's called today, and with all paranormal and supernatural occurrences, we have to deal with consciousness. We have to understand that consciousness is the medium through which we contact these things, and that human consciousness is infinitely variable, and that the receiver wavelength of the brain can be retuned, as shamans do in their daily lives using plant hallucinogens, and that this is the way for a systematic inquiry into the mystery, rather than all of us just running around like headless chickens looking for some kind of instrument that's going to measure this. We have the instrument already. It's our brains. We just need to use it in the right way.
All right, to the phones we go, east of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast with Graham Hancock. Hi there.
Hi, I'm Jerry from Baltimore, Maryland.
Hello, Jerry. Thanks for
calling. Hi, Jerry.
Also, 20 years, by the way, in St. Louis, your hometown. I listen every night, and I hear these people talking about, well, most of the time when they're sleeping in bed and they see people, and it dawned upon me, I've got narcolepsy. And a lot of the symptoms that they talk about, I have, but mine is due to narcolepsy. Now, I thought they might have narcolepsy and don't know it.
Yes, narcolepsy is another form of altered state of consciousness. It is retuning the receiver wavelength of your brain and allowing in experiences that are normally kept out by our brains.
Of course, in narcolepsy, the people just seem to fall asleep sitting at desks no matter where. They just fade off into the sunset.
And therefore lose their connection with this daily physical life, but may gain a connection with other realms of existence in that state.
Call from Wichita wants to know, fast blast, if you build up a resistance to ayahuasca so you don't have those horrible symptoms you just mentioned.
Yes. Shamans who drink ayahuasca twice a week gradually master the vomiting and the diarrhea. I've now drunk ayahuasca 16 times, and I found on the last five sessions, which took place in Brazil this year, and in fact just a couple of months ago, that I was much less nauseous than I had been before. So gradually we master these symptoms. The first few sessions are often very difficult. But I have to say that the purging is not entirely unpleasant. One does have a feeling of tremendous cleanness. It's as though you've rid your body of terrible toxins that have built up over the year. And there's a tremendous sense of relief and clarity afterwards. And always the next day after an ayahuasca session, the session typically lasts for 2 to 3 hours, always the next day, you feel very clear and very much connected to the world and very, very much alive. And I'm so confident about the medicinal and the positive values of ayahuasca that I actually took two of my children, they're adults, one is 22 and the other is 25, with me to Brazil to drink ayahuasca in a ceremonial setting. And we had an extraordinary experience of contact as a family, and they had amazing encounters with the ayahuasca spirit and came back transformed from this experience and very thoroughly grounded and connected to this world, but with a sense of the importance and significance of the worlds that lie beyond and that we normally cut ourselves off from.
Can you predict things telepathically? Can you get into people's minds when you're on the substance?
Yes, this has not happened to me, but many shamans report this. In fact, shamans will sometimes go on joint expeditions into the supernatural realm, into the other realm. They will meet each other on the other side, as well as traveling into other dimensions. They have the ability, they report the ability, to travel out of body in this world. And there's a very intriguing account from an anthropologist who was working with an Indian tribe deep in the Amazon. They drink ayahuasca twice a week. He was drinking with them. And the next day, their shaman came and reported to him, "We're very sorry to tell you, but the father of your wife died."
Oh my.
"In New York last night." And 5 days later, the anthropologist received the information from New York that exactly at the moment that they said, indeed, the father of his wife had in fact died. So they had seen this in vision. They had been able to remote view to travel to different places. And this is why I say again and again, if we want to investigate the paranormal, if we want to investigate the supernatural, we don't need to rely on cute little instruments like so-called ghost meters. We need to rely on the vast experience and knowledge of shamans in hunter-gatherer cultures around the world who do this every day and who absolutely understand these realms and these beings.
Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast. You are on the air with us. Hello there. Good morning.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Yeah, I was wondering if we can tap into other dimensions. Couldn't they tap into ours? We wouldn't know what. They could be messing with us and screwing things up as bad as our things are going on our planet. They could have. You know, they obviously have powers. They're way
very
ahead
good.
Of us.
Very good question. And this is exactly why the discipline of shamanism is so important, because what shamans are saying is we do not need to be victims of these transdimensional intelligences. We do not need to be at their mercy. We can enter their realm. We can deal with them on our own terms. I have no doubt that spiritual beings and entities are involved in much of the mischief that takes place in the world. But if we're going to deal with that mischief, then we have to deal with them. And the only way to do that, the way that human beings have developed over tens of thousands of years, is this amazing ancient system called shamanism, which is so derided and despised by modern scientists who really know nothing whatsoever about what we're talking about. In other words, these realms are all around us all the time. They're interconnected with our lives, whether we like it or not. We better know about them. We better deal with them rather than turning our backs on them.
When you take the ayahuasca, how long does it take to kick in?
Kicks kicks in after about 45 minutes. You're dealing with a small amount of liquid. It's very dark, dark in color, red or dark black, very tarry, very concentrated. It's equivalent to perhaps a double shot of whiskey in size. The moment it hits your lips, you know that you're dealing with something serious. The taste is absolutely ghastly. It is, without a doubt, the worst taste on this planet. You shudder as it goes down. Then you're okay for a little while. After about 45 minutes, you're starting to feel the nausea. You're starting to feel these ominous stomach rumblings. And at the same time, these amazing visions are beginning to present themselves before your eyes. Best seen with your eyes closed rather than eyes opened. I suppose one of the reassuring things about ayahuasca is that you can often stop the visions and come back to this world by opening your eyes. And then you're in the ayahuasca state. The vomiting is normally over within an hour and a half. You're in the ayahuasca state for the next 2.5 to 3 hours. Some people need to take a booster, take a second shot of ayahuasca to keep their level of consciousness at the right tuning. That depends on individual brain chemistry. The experience can be extended, but most people find that 2 to 3 hours of this exploration of another world, because that's what it is. It's a richly detailed world, a jungle world full of intelligent beings. 2 to 3 hours of this is enough in one night. Mm. And overwhelms you, and you need to come back and ground in this world again.
Graham, how long have you been studying this portion of what we're talking about tonight?
Well, my first encounter with ayahuasca goes back to 2003.
Not too long ago.
Not too long ago. And I came to it very reluctantly because I too had been affected by what I now clearly recognize, at least where hallucinogens is concerned, by the propaganda of the war on drugs. And I was very, very afraid. But at the same time, as a professional writer, as somebody with a commitment to bring honest and directly experienced information to my readers, I felt that if I'm going to be talking about the role of altered states of consciousness in human evolution, then I must experience those altered states myself. Many scholars who work in this field refuse to do so, but I felt I had to do so, and in 2003, I finally forced myself to do so, and my program of inquiry involved ayahuasca. It involved ibogaine from the Amazon. It involved psilocybin mushrooms. It involved pure DMT, dimethyltryptamine, all of these plant-based shamanic hallucinogens. I did work with them, and they completely changed my view of reality.
One more hour to go with our guest, Graham Hancock. Phone lines are ready. We'll be back. I'll tell you, this show is just flying by tonight. We'll be back in a moment. Graham Hancock, our guest. The rest of your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Graham, of everything that you have worked on over the years, and you've done a lot, is there an area, a subject matter that is so compelling for you, you want to keep going back to it, you want to keep revisiting that as a subject?
Well, I revisited and explored the mystery of the lost civilization over a period of 15 years up to and including my book, Underworld, in 2002. Can I just take this opportunity to mention that I'm going to be on a speaking tour in the U.S.
Oh, sure, and I hope you swing by either Los Angeles or St. Louis where I can meet you directly, will you?
Unfortunately, I won't be in St. Louis. At least it doesn't look that way at the moment. The details are up on my website under a button called Talks and Events and also on the Supernatural page of my website. I'm speaking mainly on the West Coast, certainly in Los Angeles at the Learning Annex. I'm speaking in San Diego, and I'm speaking at a conference called CPAC, the Conference on Precession and Ancient Knowledge, which is being held at Irvine University of California, just outside LA, and there I'll be giving a talk both about my previous interests, the lost civilization interest, and also about this new inquiry into the nature of reality and the role of the supernatural in human evolution. And that's between the 13th and the 15th of September. All the details are on my website, which is grahamhancock.com. Okay. Altogether, I'll be in the States for 3 weeks. I finish up in New York on the 2nd of November at the Chapel of the Sacred Mirrors. And I'm also in Boulder, but most of it is on the West Coast.
Okay. I thought you said the 13th and 15th of September. Did you mean October?
I mean October, yes, of course.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Excuse me. I'm getting displaced in time. Yes, I mean the 13th to the 15th of October. I'm actually arriving in the U.S. on the 9th, and my first event is in San Diego at the Learning Annex on the 11th. And then the CPAC conference at Irvine is between the 13th and the 15th of October, as you rightly say.
Very good. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. You're on the air with Graham Hancock. Hi there.
Yes. Hi. What an honor. This is Mayumi. I'm in Sacramento, California.
Hello. Hi. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Yes, this is Mayumi. I'm calling because I was wondering if you've ever tried shamanic drumming to reach the altered states.
Yes, drumming very frequently accompanies ayahuasca sessions, and I know many individuals who have succeeded in getting into the necessary altered state with drumming alone. I know that shamanic drumming is a very effective technique, and for those who prefer not to use the ancient plant hallucinogens that many shamans work with, rhythmic drumming is another very effective means for altering consciousness. Some people find it easier to go into an altered state than others under the influence of rhythmic drumming, but it certainly does work.
Oh, wonderful. And I had a question about Huna. I know my grandfather was really deeply involved and about Huna. What do you know about that?
Sorry, I'm not quite sure what you're referring to.
I was wondering, is Huna a shamanic kind of thing also?
I'm lost as to what Huna is, sorry.
Huna. So am I. I've never heard of that. How do you spell that?
Never heard of Huna? It's a Hawaiian religion, ancient religion.
Right.
Yes. I guess Max Freedom Long in the 50s was writing about it.
Okay. And I don't know. You can't address that, Graham.
Almost certainly does involve the shamanism. The ancient religion of Hawaii and of many of the islands in the Pacific did do so.
I learn something on this show every night.
Yeah.
Every night. East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. It's a privilege to speak with you. My name is Peter. I'm calling from Plaski, New York, from WSYR, Syracuse. I am officially the president of Eastern Shore Chapter Paranormal. And Mr. Graham, you hit a nerve with me.
Thank you.
I've been a researcher for over 25 years of the paranormal.
Yes.
I am known as a Ghostbuster.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like these entities cross over to this dimension, not us going over there. Anybody can take hallucinogenic drugs, and I don't advise it. Because that
Have you taken ayahuasca or any hallucinogen yourself?
Yeah, many years ago I took marijuana,
but that's not.
And it caused me.
That's not a hallucinogen. I'm just wondering on what basis.
No,
basis you don't advise that people acquaint themselves with a 10,000-year-old religious practice.
Why? Because it opens one person up for an entity to take over a body. It's called possession.
No, in my experience, that is not the case, unless the individual is unfortunately mentally compromised in some way, perhaps a schizophrenic, in which case I definitely wouldn't advise taking any hallucinogen. If the individual is normal and sane and balanced, they will emerge from the experience normal and sane and balanced, and it's complete nonsense.
Sir,
that normal, sane, balanced individuals can be tipped over the edge by hallucinogens. They can't.
Are you speaking on a religion, or are you speaking scientifically?
Well, I'm speaking scientifically. On the observation of studies of hallucinogens, they do have bad effects on people who are already mentally damaged. But for those of us who are sane and balanced, they do not have effects. And as the point of view of a religion, we have to understand that shamanism is the oldest religion on our planet, and we must not fall into the Western mistake of despising it. And we must realize that shamans have always cultivated altered states of consciousness, and the time-honored and respected method for doing that are the use of certain plants that have co-evolved with us. Of course, there are other methods as well, but we shouldn't just despise that. We should recognize the value and the validity of shamanic experience. One of the big mistakes in the West is that we just write off a whole religious culture because we don't like the way it does things.
You know, another reason why the governments aren't allowing this, these substances, could be because they haven't decided how to tax it yet.
Well, yes, that may indeed be the case. I mean, personally speaking, I can't think of any other area of public policy where other than the war on drugs, where policies that have absolutely failed, that completely failed to achieve their objectives. Drugs are awash in our society today. I can't think of any other public policy that has been maintained for more than 40 years, that has had billions of dollars plowed into it, that has so spectacularly failed to achieve its objectives and yet still gets billions of dollars plowed into it. It just doesn't make sense to me. It's a completely crazy system. But we must distinguish between different kinds of so-called drugs. And these sacred and ancient plants that have been used by shamanic cultures all around the world for tens of thousands of years, these have been field tested on human beings throughout our history with no ill effects. And it's time that our governments and those of us who are prejudiced towards them realize this. And at the very least, we should not despise the shamans for what they do. They just may know something that we don't know.
You know, it's too bad that with the ayahuasca, what we have to go through in order to get into that state.
Well, I think the physical effects are very important, actually. I found it very difficult at first to sit down amongst a group of villagers in the Amazon, drink this foul-tasting brew, and then find myself afflicted with diarrhea and vomiting,
oh,
basically in a public setting. I mean, this went against everything that I, as a Westerner, have been conditioned to. You know, we like to keep our toilet habits very private in the West. But what it taught me is that I'm placing far too much importance on my own body and on the processes of my own body, and that really what is the essence of me? It's not my stomach. The essence of me is my brain, is my consciousness. And that is the beautiful experience, the challenging, the thought-provoking, the deeply enchanted and mysterious experience that ayahuasca offers us. And if the price it charges for that is a little bit of nausea and diarrhea, then I'm certainly prepared to pay it.
Do you have to hold your nose when you're drinking it down?
It helps very much to have a lemon nearby, and just after drinking it, to take a little bit of that, just to nibble on that lemon and have a little bit of lemon juice. It kind of neutralizes the bad taste in the mouth. The smell of ayahuasca does even now make me gag, even if I'm not going to drink it. Even thinking about it makes me gag. But so remarkable are the experiences, and so healing have been its effects on me. For example, I have been a lifelong sufferer from the most catastrophic migraines, sometimes as many as 20 migraine headaches a month. Since I worked with ayahuasca, my migraines have stopped entirely. I don't have them anymore. Completely gone. And that's such a gift from the plants. I can't thank the spirits of the plants enough for freeing me from that pain.
Let's go west of the Rockies. You're on the air with Mr. Graham Hancock. Hi there.
Good evening, George. Congratulations on the book.
Oh, thank you.
And you've made me a night bird, even though everybody tells me I should get to bed by 10.
No, no.
And I wanted to ask Graham, I've studied shamanism a little bit with Michael Harner, and
yes.
I've never taken ayahuasca, but I had an experience this year that I wonder if you could help me. Sounds very much like what you're talking about. I became really very ill because of a toxic exposure to mold in an apartment that, it's another story, but
yeah.
Really, I became very sick, and I was desperately trying to move out, and it became worse and worse until I started to hallucinate.
Yes.
For 3 days. Now, mold is a plant-like substance.
Yes.
And they're also using it in bio-warfare.
Mold is, of course, a fungus.
Well, I had no idea that it could make you hallucinate.
Well, let me tell you that ergot, which is also a mold, which is also a fungus, is the basis of LSD. LSD mm-hmm. was synthesized from a mold,
mm-hmm.
from the ergot fungus, and indeed in the fungus family, find huge numbers of hallucinogens.
It was amazing because I was hallucinating, but I was still in the same consciousness, that I could still function, so to speak, but I was aware that there were like messages, like all these, like what you're talking about, lessons coming through for me about what I had to do in life. But the strangest thing, I did see a doctor who was one of two specialists in the U.S. on this, and he said, oh, yes, hallucinations are very common with this. And I had not read that anywhere before. But I asked him about a hallucination I had for 3 days. Every time I opened my eyes, I saw black handwriting, script handwriting, like medieval handwriting, everywhere in my visual field. And
very interesting. That's very common with DMT, by the way.
Is it? That's what I wanted to ask you.
Is to see scripts. And often as one is looking at this script rolling before one's eyes, one can't actually read it, but there's a sense, nevertheless, that information is being conveyed into the brain. It's like downloading a huge quantity of information that you might need years to integrate into your life, but the information is there on your hard disk, as it were.
Is that what happened? Because when you said before that this is written in our DNA, that's what prompted me to call.
Well, yes, this
writing.
This is an area we've not had a chance to get into too much in detail in the conversation tonight, but it is another explanation for why people all over the world, and going back 35,000 years in history, all record the same experiences with the same supernatural beings in altered states of consciousness. Either these things are a freestanding, free-existing spirit world, other dimensions, and that's actually the view that I favor, or in some mysterious manner, they have been written on our DNA since life first mysteriously arrived on this planet 3.9 billion years ago, and that DNA has been in all life ever since, awaiting the evolution of a creature that was capable of reading the message inscribed on it, and that creature is us.
It was fascinating because as sick as I was aware that I was into another frequency.
Yes.
And I kept thinking, wow, this is absolutely amazing. I have to research this after I get better, you know.
Good for you, you know, because most people are just so frightened by these experiences that they don't want to touch them again. And in fact, what we really ought to do is say here is a whole other realm of human experience. It may be very valuable, and we need to explore this realm. And find out what it means to us. And that is the view of shamans. So I would say you're on your first step to becoming a shaman. And you say you worked with Michael Harner. Of course, Michael Harner worked with rhythmic drumming, but also with ayahuasca.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Aloha from Hawaii.
Well, hello there. Thank you.
Hi.
Graham, it's such an exciting show. I've heard some of the best shows ever on George's program, and this one has the possibility of opening the minds of millions of Americans and possibly internationally to the possibility of plants and what they're here to teach us.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that. I hope that this show and my book, Supernatural, can in some way contribute to do that, to bring in a huge body of information which is rationally and scientifically presented, which allows us, gives us permission, if you like, to explore these extraordinary possibilities that our society has been so down on for so long.
Well, I want to say bravo on how you treated that last, obviously, schizophrenic caller who related marijuana to demonic possession.
Yes, but marijuana cannot be linked to demonic possession. Unfortunately, there are people do have preformed views which are not based on their own experience, but simply what they've heard on the news media, and they haven't really paused to sit down and analyze these views properly.
You know, Graham, I also would wish that governments, at least in this country, the United States, would allow the medicinal use of marijuana to help people. I have interviewed so many people in my broadcasting career who cannot take pharmaceutical prescription pain pills.
Absolutely.
Makes them sick. It doesn't work.
Absolutely.
Yet they have tried medicinal marijuana for their pain and their ailments.
And
it works. Dramatic changes.
It works instantly. It is truly a healing and positive plant for so many people. And again, it's a sign of the madness and the criminal violence of our society that it dictates whether or not we may experience the healing effects of this plant. It is an extraordinary thing to call the consumption of marijuana a crime. It is a victimless crime, if it's a crime at all. An individual alone in his or her own house, sampling a plant which has been with humanity since the beginning of time, for that to be called criminal is insane. We live in an insane society that believes it has a right to patrol even our consciousness. not only to tell us how to behave out there in public, but to tell us actually what to think and what to experience. And that's the main objection to marijuana by our governments, is the effect that it has on consciousness. And they don't care that it is a fantastic pain reliever, which it is. They don't care about its wonderful medical properties. They just want to stop anybody experiencing these effects on consciousness. And no wonder our society is in such a mess, where we imagine we live in a democracy and yet elect governments that actually have the nerve to tell us what we may and may not experience inside our own heads without doing any harm to others.
Yet the poppy fields flourish in Afghanistan.
The poppy fields flourish in Afghanistan. There is so much hypocrisy, so much humbug in government positions on these matters. Governments know perfectly well that the rules that they have made, the misery that they inflict on people's lives, don't get rid of these problems. If we really want to solve the problem of drugs, we need to open up the whole issue to broad public discussion, and we have to accept and admit that certain plant products, such as these ancient hallucinogens that shamans use, are entirely beneficial in their interaction with the human race.
Maybe they don't want us to open up our minds.
This is what governments are afraid of. They are afraid of a citizenry that is fully conscious. They actually want us to be unconscious. They want us to simply focus on this alert, problem-solving, competitive mentality that makes us good consumers and good competitors in the business place. But they don't want us to explore the majestic and amazing depths of our consciousness, because then we just might start asking questions that would be very uncomfortable for the powers that be.
Graham Hancock, stick around for final phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, it'll be that typical Friday night and the Saturday morning open line, so make sure you're part of the program as we take you into the weekend right here on Coast to Coast AM. Graham, can you tell us a little bit about junk DNA, what you believe it is, before we go back to final callers?
Yes, just to go quickly into that, we talked about Francis Crick earlier, the discoverer of the structure of DNA, for which he won a Nobel Prize. And I mentioned one astonishing fact about Francis Crick, which he admitted shortly before his death in 2004, which is that he was under the influence of a hallucinogen, under the influence of LSD, when he first saw the double helix structure of DNA. So this vision, this teaching came to him in an altered state of consciousness. Now, later in his life, in fact, in the 1980s, this Nobel Prize winner, Francis Crick, published an extraordinary book called Life Itself, in which he argues from a scientific point of view that life, the DNA molecule, which is the essence of life, could not have got started by accident on this planet. He didn't believe it could. He compared it to, he said it's about as likely that, you know, this idea of the primeval soup and molecules accidentally bumping against each other, producing life, which so many of our scientists
mm-hmm,
like.
Sure.
Crick compared that to, thought that was about as likely as the assembly of a fully functioning jumbo jet by a hurricane in a junkyard. It is just such an extraordinarily complicated molecule, the DNA molecule, and its relationship to the proteins equally complicated. So to cut a long story short, he suggested it was sent here by an alien civilization from the other side of the universe who faced certain doom, perhaps, as a result of a supernova explosion. They sought to preserve the essence of life, and so they sent bacteria out into the universe in spaceships loaded with DNA. Those bacteria, one of those spaceships, crashed into the early Earth. This theory is Crick's theory. It's called directed panspermia. Its cargo of bacteria spilled out and started reproducing and evolving and eventually became us. And that's honestly how Francis Crick, the Nobel Prize winner, saw the beginning of life on this planet. Now, if by chance he was right, and we can't dismiss that, the man won a Nobel Prize, after all, for the study of DNA, then we have to consider another possibility, which is that that supposed civilization on the other side of the galaxy that sent DNA to this planet may have genetically engineered that DNA it's recently been discovered that DNA is a fantastic recording medium. Patents are being taken out all over the world to use DNA as a recording device, that it would be possible to record vast quantities of information on DNA. Right now, today, our scientists can record 100-word songs on DNA, and it's been done on the DNA of the E. coli bacteria. But the evidence suggests that its storage capacity is limitless, perhaps even enough to record the entire knowledge of a civilization. So that's the idea, that maybe on so-called junk DNA, which is 97% of our DNA, only 3% of our DNA is involved in genes. The rest, we don't know what it does, and the scientists call it junk DNA. Maybe that contains and has contained since the beginning of evolution recorded messages, interactive recorded information from our makers, waiting for the evolution of a creature that would be able to understand those messages and decode them. And the suggestion is that creature is us, and the decoding method is altered states of consciousness. So this is a parallel possibility that I review in Supernatural, along with the possibility that spirit worlds are real, which I repeat is my favorite of the two possibilities.
First time caller line, you're on the air with us. Good morning.
Oh, hi. My name is Rick from San Diego.
Hey, Rick.
Hi, it's an honor to be on your show, George.
Thank you.
One comment I wanted to make was I want to make a comment and ask a question of
sure.
My question, my comment is, you know, I since I started studying DMT and when I read Rick Strassman's book two years ago, it has occurred to me that the final solution to this war on drugs will be to put a microchip in all of us to suppress our DMT.
Yes.
That would be that's the real meaning behind Revelations, because by cutting us off from DMT, it cuts us off from God, this microchip that will be placed in all of us.
Can I just come in there? Because that's a very interesting point that you're making. Firstly, the way you see our society developing, unfortunately, you're absolutely right. Our society is developing more and more in the direction of a thought police that control every thought we have. And for those thought police, the powers that be in the states that run our lives, the DMT molecule is particularly terrifying because it is, in fact, as you rightly observe, produced by our own brains. Rick Strassman's excellent work at the University of New Mexico, which I report in Supernatural, demonstrated absolutely that DMT is produced in the pineal gland in the brain, and that DMT seems to be our inbuilt mechanism for accessing the other world. In other words, our evolution has made absolutely certain that we can reach the other world, even if we can't get access to plants, because that spirit molecule, as Rick Strassman calls it, is already inside our brain. So yes, the next step in thought control would be to inhibit that spirit molecule and stop any of us ever again from entering the visionary realm.
All right, let's go to our wild card line. It's your turn. Thanks for holding.
Hi, George. It's a pleasure to talk with you again.
Thank you.
Mr. Hancock, I look forward to reading your book, first of all.
Thank you.
And I'm struck by some symbolism here. You mentioned earlier that there was an image on a cave wall of a human with horns and hooves.
Yes.
And
the earliest image ever painted by our ancestors to have come down to us.
Interesting. That conjures up, for me, that to my mind, that's reminiscent of the age-old worldwide symbol of the devil. And then you said that, and a probable variant of the goat of Mendes. And then you said that the ayahuasca spirit appears to many as a snake or a group of snakes. Well, there you go with some more satanic or demonic symbolism.
Yes,
so my
you have to remember that the Christian scriptures are edited documents, and if you go to the Gnostic scriptures, which were suppressed by the early Christians, and I'm not surprised they suppressed them because they were afraid of them, if you go to the Gnostic scriptures, you'll find that the serpent is presented as the good guy, not as the bad guy. The serpent is bringing knowledge, after all, to Adam and Eve in the garden.
Gnosticism.
It seems a strange kind of God that would wish to keep the human creature with its wonderful brain in ignorance.
The serpent
is a liberator.
I've studied Freemasonry, and they worship the snake as a symbol of wisdom and all that. And I'm absolutely convinced it has evil connotations after looking at Quetzalcoatl in Mexico and what they're doing.
I beg to differ.
Look at the Freemasonry and the New World Order, and you may open your eyes. So my question is, you've never considered that there may be an evil component to these visions?
I'm certain that the other world includes evil as well as good. No doubt about that. Evil is all around us as well as good. The unique predicament of the human being is that we have the power of choice.
We do not have to do evil. We do not have to think evil. We do not have to act in an evil way. We can choose. We are not the victims of these forces. So just as we encounter evil in everyday life and must make our personal choices about it, so also we will encounter evil in the spirit world. But we are free to make our choices. We are not puppets. We are not robots. We are human beings with consciousness, and our consciousness is our greatest gift, and we must use every opportunity to explore it rather than shutting it down.
Interesting. Thank you. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Graham Hancock. Hi there.
Hi, this is Nick. I'm calling from South Dakota.
Hello, Nick. Go ahead, sir.
My question for Graham is this. I've been taking some medication, basically just for some mental disorders and such. And I've always kind of had strange feelings, I don't really care to take them, but I'm kind of concerned about getting off of them. I tried that before, and it had some pretty bad repercussions. But I'm wondering what the adverse effects may be of taking something like that, and if there's
You mean prescription medications?
Yeah.
I think here's the danger, that modern prescription medications for psychological issues are the result of 10 or 20 or 30 years of study. Our scientists, in other words, don't really know what they're doing. They deal out all these antidepressants and other kinds of psychological drugs, but their track record, their testing period in the human race is 10 or 20 or 30 years. Much better to use plants that have been with humanity since the beginning for tens of thousands of years, never doing any harm. And this is why the shamans, I believe, know much more than the pharmaceutical companies know. There are grave dangers with pharmaceutical psychological drugs, grave dangers, and they can have devastating side effects, although there's no doubt that in some cases they also do help.
Okay, thanks. Let's go now to east of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hello there.
Hi. George, Graham, nice to talk to you.
Hi.
I'd like to thank the screener, too. She's pretty pleasant. But first of all, I agree with the stuff about the serpent and all that, with your side of it, Graham. Because
thank you.
Zachariah Sitchin and others like that have talked about that kind of stuff, and it's really interesting. But that's another subject. You talk about, I'm a little nervous.
Don't worry.
But,
give us a second and we'll help you out here. What direction were you going in?
You talk about DMT. You had, artists had other guests on it, talked about it too. And at first I thought that you were that same guest. And then until you said that you hadn't, taken it until 2003.
That's right, yeah.
And so
you're thinking of the late, great Terence McKenna, who was one of the brilliant thinkers in this field and one of the great explorers of supernatural realms.
Well, I was living in Arizona when I first heard that, and I did a little research on it, and it talked about being near water had an effect.
Yeah.
And that's interesting, the fact that you talk about, I didn't put two and two together then, but it's interesting that you talk about being in these rainforests whenever these shamans are using it. So that's all interesting, but I didn't pursue it for very long because I was.
Well, water is to do with the power of place. Rivers, great oceans, lakes, often these can have an effect on our consciousness. What I'm trying to get across is that human consciousness is infinitely variable and that it is affected by many different things, and these effects can retune the receiver wavelength of our consciousness. And so certain environmental phenomena, such as rivers and lakes, undoubtedly do exercise an effect on consciousness as well, and shamans have known this since the beginning of time.
Graham, where do you get the book Supernatural? How do you find it?
Well, Supernatural is available in, of course, all good stores. It's available on Amazon.com. Just look up my name, Graham Hancock, Supernatural, and there it is. It's available through my website, www.GrahamHancock.com, and it'll be, of course, available at all the venues that I'm speaking at in October on my tour in the United States. If my publishers have done their job, Supernatural should be in all the shops, and it's certainly available on Amazon.com.
Excellent. International Line, where are you calling from? You're on the air. Hi there.
Hi there. My name is Mark from Canada, Winnipeg,
hey,
Canada. My question for Graham is this. Talks about in the Bible, various scriptures in the Bible, where stay away from strong drink, and it's in the Old Testament and the New Testament. It also talks about stay away from drink, stay away from drug. And I was just wondering, I know that you talked about that modern society has got like a prejudiced eye or a prejudiced view on that sort of thing. But I was wondering, what is your take on why would the Bible and the scriptures that it were written thousands of years ago, why would they warn us to not get involved with drugs and with strong drink? And it also talks about do not contact the spirit world, do not get in touch with mediums.
Good question. Good.
Why would the Bible do that?
Good question. Thank you. Thank you very much for asking it. I have two chapters in Supernatural where I try to show that every religion that we have in the world today, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, it doesn't matter which religion you choose, if you trace it right back to its origins, you're going to find a shamanic experience, an experience of contact with other worlds. In a sense, Christ is the ultimate shamanistic figure who moves between realms, who is a guide of souls, who is a healer. St. Paul on the Damascus Road has a stunning vision that completely changes the direction of his life. These are the shamanic experiences at the root, at the foundation of all the world's religions. But then, you know what happens? Within a few generations, the money men and the bureaucrats come in, the power-hungry priests who want to control everything about the people who come under them. And the first thing these individuals do who are not themselves in contact with the supernatural realm, who are simply bureaucrats and power mongers, the first thing that they do is that they ban and forbid all of us to have any direct contact with the supernatural realm because they greedily want to monopolize that position. They want to be the sole intermediaries. And so, unfortunately, all the religions that we have in the world today, although they have a spark at their beginning of direct contact with the supernatural, pretty soon we're looking at things that are really like large corporations or even armies, which are run in a hierarchical fashion and which seek to dictate to the flock what the flock, and notice that word flock, as though we're all sheep, mindless sheep, to dictate to us what we may and may not experience. So it's not surprising that all of the mainstream religions ban and punish, and in fact used to burn at the stake, anybody who explored the supernatural world directly. It's all about control. It's all about power. And that, in the next stage of the human race, as we move forward into this 21st century, that is the burden we have to overcome. We have to take control again of our birthright, which is a birthright of direct contact with the spirit, of admitting the spirit into our lives, of living conscious lives, full of love and caring, not deeply unconscious lives, full of hatred and mistrust, which is what is encouraged in the world today.
Let's go to our final caller. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
This is Mary Michael in Salt Lake. And I have MS, and my doctor is from India, and I started with a shaman. And then I go through crystal balls, and I do it every night just to calm down and relax. And I'm taken places looking through the crystal balls and meditating. Does that make sense to you?
It makes perfect sense to me. Mirror gazing, crystal balls, reflective sheets of water, all of these have been powerful techniques that shamans have used to alter their consciousness. It doesn't have to be the plant hallucinogens. There are a whole range of other techniques, rhythmic dance, drumming, and crystal gazing, which also achieve the same effect. And it sounds to me like you are very much in tune with that method of altering your consciousness.
And you have to be, and it takes time. Maybe we do
it
have
takes time.
Time
for it one. Takes it takes work. You know, one thing I have to say about ayahuasca and about the alterations of consciousness. These alterations of consciousness, in my view, are revealers of truth. They can show you what is true about the world, about reality, and about yourself. But the next step is what you do with that knowledge, and that's where the work comes in. Taking a shamanic plant hallucinogen is not an automatic road to enlightenment. It will show you what is real, but the rest is up to you. You have to do the work, and it's very hard work and dedicated work and requires the total commitment of your personality and your intelligence.
Graham Hancock, we've got 1 minute left. Anything else you want to wrap up by saying to our audience?
Well, just to say and to understand that science is wrong when it teaches us that the world can be reduced to those things that we can weigh and measure and count. There are extraordinary mysteries all around us. And our society is doing everything in its power to close our eyes and our senses to those mysteries. We need to open our eyes and our senses again, using any techniques that are available, learning from the fantastic experience of shamans accumulated over tens of thousands of years, to understand that we live in a complex and beautiful universe surrounded by dimensions that normally we can't see, but that in certain states of consciousness we can access, and that will heal us, and that will teach us, and that will help us once again to be fully human.
Graham, thanks for being on the program. Very enlightening.
Thank you. Great to talk to you.
For Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Antonia Giordano, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.